Hi, I'm Josephine Ensign, author of Skid Road, On the Frontier of Health and Homelessness in an American City, and Way Home, Journeys Through Homelessness. For the past 40 years, I've worked as a nurse practitioner providing primary care to people experiencing poverty and homelessness. I have the lived experience of homelessness as a young adult. I live and work in Seattle, a city with our nation's third highest number of people experiencing homelessness. Only New York City and Los Angeles have higher numbers. The Skid Road podcast aims to amplify a diversity of voices about homelessness in the Seattle area. Beginning in 2015, when a state of emergency was declared for homelessness in our city and county, I've done a series of oral history interviews with local people living and working at the intersection of health and homelessness. Public health nurses, emergency department physicians, politicians, heads of nonprofit agencies, activists, and frontline staff. People who have not only endured homelessness, but who are now housed and are working on creative solutions to homelessness. I've learned a lot from my conversations with all of these people, and I want to share their insights with you. On a semi-weekly basis, I'll post a new podcast episode featuring these conversations, interspersed with some of my own reflections. Learn more about this project through my website at josephineensign.com. Please subscribe to this podcast and share it with others. Thanks for listening. So, Josephine Ensign, I'm here today at Jack Straw Studios, and it's January 31st, 2017. And I have the pleasure of being here with Simha Reddy, physician. And so, thank you so much for being here. And as we were discussing, this is for the Skid Road Project, which is really looking at trying to tease out the complexities of the history and the current state of charity healthcare, especially in King County and Washington. So the first question I have for you, Simha, is what led you to the work that you do?
Sure. Would you like me to describe the work a little bit, or
yes, would be excellent. Yes.
Well, right now I serve as a medical director for a program called HPACT at the Seattle VA Medical Center here, and it's basically a primary care team that's focused on taking care of our most vulnerable homeless veterans, finding them in the community, making sure they get connected to housing, primary care, mental health care, and all that. But sort of what got me there, I came out to Seattle back in 2009 to do my residency in internal medicine here at the U, and had a remarkable experience. And sort of over my 3 years here, realized I wanted to do primary care, and I really wanted to do it in kind of an urban, underserved area, just because the work seemed more interesting. And but there were two kind of big influences in particular. The first was Nancy Sugg. And she's, you know, influenced a lot of people over the years.
I keep hearing her name, right? She'll have to be interviewed
absolutely.
If she's willing.
You know, she helped found, I think, and directed the Pioneer Square Clinic. Mm-hmm. It's run by Harborview for many years. And she coordinated at that time the healthcare for the homeless rotation for residents. So we'd spend a month, sometimes with her at the clinic. She took us on a tour of, you know, different places that served our homeless neighbors. So places like 1811 Eastlake and Third Avenue Clinic and that sort of thing. But also gave us an opportunity to experience some other things, like going to the needle exchange. And most influential for me was getting to spend some time with the healthcare for the homeless nursing staff. Mm-hmm. I would go spend time with them at some of these project-based housing environments. So buildings where people lived in sort of subsidized housing and who had struggled for years beforehand and needed a little extra support. And the kind of medicine those nurses practiced was really appealing because you'd we'd just be hanging out in the nurse's office, and people would come in, knock on the door, and they'd, you know, say, hey, how's it going? And they'd talk about the game a little bit, and she'd invite them in and say, hey, let me check that blood pressure. By the way, do you remember to take your pills yesterday? You know, did you, how was that visit yesterday with Dr. So-and-so? And knew people backwards and forwards, mm-hmm. right? And it never felt like a visit. I mean, it never felt like a medical visit. It felt like a social visit.
Mm-hmm.
But we'd still see a ton of people, had a deep connection with people, and was clearly helping them live better. And, you know, would go up and knock on people's doors if she hadn't seen them in a little while, was worried about them. And that was hugely influential, because it felt very old-fashioned, right? Rather than sitting in a clinic room with patients coming in and then going out and then on your turf, it felt like the old docs would go and visit people in their homes,
yeah,
right?
Home visits, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. This is exactly what that was. And it worked better. It seemed like it anyway. And I was like, this is really cool. This is really interesting. And and then towards the end of my third year of residency, so, you know, getting towards the end, I hadn't even started looking for a job yet, because my son was about to be born. I'm like, going to focus on that.
Yeah, that takes
right?
attention, yeah. right?
At some point along the way, one of my buddies is like, oh, my, I can't believe you haven't started looking. Like, you know, go check out the VA. They've got this cool position for like a night hospitalist thing or whatever. And I'm like, sure, that sounds fine. I've done that before. It was fun. And it'll like give me a little bit more time with my kid just because of the hours, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that'll give me some time to sort of figure out exactly where I want to be. But in the meantime, a new opportunity came up. It's for – they were going to hire a primary care physician specifically for homeless veterans, and they needed somebody to build that program. And I sort of heard through the grapevine that this existed. So when I went in for my interview for that hospitalist thing, and they sort of said, hey, actually,
by the way,
I heard about something different. Could I try that instead?
And was it called HPACT back then?
It was just coming online across the country,
right.
basically,
yeah.
And it was called HPACT back then. That was the new program. Nobody sort of knew what it was.
Right. And so maybe just for the record, for the future, like
yeah.
what HPACT stands
for. Absolutely. So it stands for, you know, the VA loves acronyms, right?
Mm-hmm.
It stands for Homeless Patient Aligned Care Team. And so
okay.
PACT has been a buzzword at the VA for many years, and it's pretty remarkable. It's essentially a medical home. It's this idea that patients don't need just a doctor. They need a team sort of keeping track and
mm-hmm.
sort of making sure that things are going well. And the idea was, okay, well, let's take that medical home model and find ways to overcome barriers specifically for people who are homeless and veterans who are homeless. Because the traditional things, right, calling them for an appointment that's going to be 2 weeks out, getting lab results in the mail, remembering to make your appointment, bus fare there, all of that sort of thing, right? Yeah, if you're homeless, you can do it, maybe, if you've got the resources and the wherewithal. But if you don't even know where you're going to eat that night or sleep that night, it's a lot to
mm-hmm.
ask. And so a lot of people are slipping through the cracks, and the idea was maybe there's a better way. And healthcare for the homeless, you know, as sort of a federally funded organization, has been doing this for decades now across the nation. And the VA sort of took a bit of a page from their book
mm-hmm.
In saying, let's provide population-specific care. And this is something that I hope people know about, but I'll sort of talk about again. At the end of 2009, beginning 2010, Secretary of the VA Eric Shinseki, with President Obama, made a commitment to end veteran homelessness
mm-hmm.
Within 5 years. They said, you know, no one who has served our country should be living on the streets. And, you know, obviously no one should be living on the streets, but that was the thing that they could control.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, okay, this is going to be our moonshot. We're going to do it. And even at the time, I think Secretary Shinseki said, you know, if we don't shoot for something along the lines, if you don't shoot for the stars, you're never going to get anywhere. And the VA put their money where the mouth was and made remarkable progress. And most of those resources went towards housing, mm-hmm. appropriately so. Housing and case management and social work. Because I think, despite some of the rhetoric, the real solution to homelessness is housing, right? That's the cure. It's not all these other things. It's housing. But it doesn't mean that it can't be aided by stabilization of mental health care, primary care, and everything else. And by 2012, there had been a model for this. So I think San Francisco had already been doing some really great work. The San Francisco VA, I mean, mm-hmm. had been doing some really great work. And then actually in Providence, Rhode Island, Dr. Tom O'Toole had spearheaded, who is now the national director for HPACT, mm-hmm. Spearheaded this model of a primary care team focused on homeless veterans, and it was really successful in sort of getting people engaged in care. And, you know, after, you know, having a couple of sites that were doing good work, they rolled it out to 30 new sites, mm-hmm. you know, all in 1 year. And it was a big jump. And that was 2012, and Seattle got one of those grants to pilot it for a couple of years. And
so that's when you were coming in with the interview.
Yeah. But interestingly, the other person that I think has had a huge influence and really set the template for the program we have now here in Puget Sound is Dr. David Wu. And he was an internist working in the primary care clinic here at the Seattle VA for years. He's now a palliative care physician out on the East Coast. But during his time at the VA, he had made a decision that he wanted to do outreach to homeless veterans as well, and so had negotiated for about a half day a week where he could go do that. And he was spending time at various shelters in the community, connecting with homeless veterans and trying to encourage them to come in for care. But he didn't really have, you know, he didn't have any additional support in terms of like nursing staff, mm-hmm. social work support, aside from the traditional primary care. Was really doing some tremendous and built some really great relationships. But, you know, just as that HPACT program was coming online, he had made a decision to jump towards palliative care and make a little bit of a career shift. And so that left this opening, as well as a template for how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I came on board just after graduating residency. So this was my first gig out of training. It would have been, I guess, August when I started of 2012. And there was a nurse, Brian Hopps, and social worker Megan Crumpets, who were already on board by that point. And then it was the three of us. We sort of built our program from that point forward. We got really lucky in that we got a huge amount of support from our leadership, from our clinic director, from our what they call service line leader, basically, you know, oversees all of primary care. Because basically they said, we're going to give you free rein. We don't know what this needs to look like exactly, but we trust you guys to do what's right. And that was exactly what we needed. So I didn't walk into a panel of 1,000 patients, which would have taken up all my time. Instead, mm-hmm. I got, you know, I had a handful of people, you know, left over from Dr. Wu's panel. And then basically an open book to say, to figure out what to do.
And some staff support.
And staff support, yeah. Right. And so it was the three of us, Megan, Brian, myself, and we started hitting up basically every shelter we could find around the area for months, and would go back on, you know, frequently trying to get to know staff, trying to figure out where we were going to have the highest yield, and, you know, played around a lot with sort of how we were going to structure our clinic. So appointments, walk-ins, when are we going to be available, that sort of thing. Finally settled on a model in which really encouraged walk-in access. You know, any afternoon, somebody can come in to see us, and outreach in the mornings to different places. So like the DSC shelter, mm-hmm. the Compass Hygiene Center, the William Booth Center, which is run by the Salvation Army, and, you know, as far north as Everett, the Everett Gospel Mission, and different places we'd go to with different frequency. Some of the places we went to initially really wonderful places that do phenomenal work, places like the Urban Rest Stop, Bread of Life, Union Gospel Mission. But we just weren't seeing as many veterans there. And sort of with limited time, we said, okay, here's where we're going to focus.
Focus on the others, yeah.
But it was this model of outreach to find veterans who were otherwise not going to necessarily make it up to the hospital, right, for a wide variety of reasons. One, practical issues, bus fare, confusion, sort of just, you know.
How they were treated, perhaps.
How they were treated, yeah. Exactly. Like, I mean, a number of people had been burned by healthcare generally or the VA specifically and were not necessarily eager to you know, see that again. And so our job was to rebuild some of those relationships and, you know, frankly, do a little bit of, like, advertising. Be like, hey, we want to be here for you. Here at this hygiene center every week. Come on by, check in with me. You don't even have to tell me your name. Just let's hang out a little bit, and when you feel comfortable, we'll talk more. And that made a big difference, I think. So we had these different populations, right? So the people who weren't making it up to clinic or the hospital, and then the people who were only getting sort of urgent or acute care at the hospital, right? Like, they were hitting the ER, like, you know, three times a week, but not actually getting better because there was no continuity. So that was the other big population we focused on. We sort of, you know, talked to the ER staff, talked to the other primary care doctors on the team, and we're like, who are the folks that are really struggling? And we'd love to have them. And they were thrilled to be able to, like, have somebody else
kind of help, you know, fill in the gaps, yeah.
And so that was and that's sort of – that's what we've been building over the last 4 or 5 years.
And also you had a program specifically trying to reach out and address homeless women as well, right, veterans?
Not particularly. When we first started, you know, there's this question of what's – when we see homeless women veterans, what's going to be most beneficial to them? During outreach, really, like, I would work closely with a handful of, you know, women veterans who would come by, and, you know, there was a couple that I would see every week, basically, and sort of do a check-in and make sure things are going okay. But for the most part, there's a separate women's clinic up at the VA, and in some ways, I think provides, for most of the people I was saying, was able to provide better care than I could. So obviously sort of specific women's health issues, like gynecologic issues, but also a more comfortable place to be seen. That it can, you know, from some of the women who had struggled with the military sexual trauma, being in a waiting room with, you know, a lot of
men,
yeah,
right,
was not the ideal thing. And so often serve more as in a support role in that situation where, like, I may not be the primary doc, but I may help do coordination stuff. That being said, I definitely have, you know, some women veterans where they feel comfortable coming up. Love to have them.
So what have been some of, like, the biggest joys for you? Like, is there a kind of a memorable moment for you in your work that you'd be willing to share?
Yeah, I think, I mean, the reason I do this is because I enjoy it. I think if I wasn't enjoying it and was, I couldn't sustain in this. You know, every day, I think the joy that comes in this particular position, right, being a primary care doc is, yeah, I do the diabetes stuff. I do the cholesterol and the statins and all the normal primary care stuff. But a lot of just counseling. And one of the real privileges that we get as providers, of all types certainly, but I've been certainly in my case has been the privilege of hearing stories, right? Hearing about people's lives, and that's the biggest joy that I get, to hear where people are coming from and where they're headed and what their dreams are about, where they want to be. And, you know, the biggest joys are you know, those times when we can graduate people. Because, you know, at any given time, I'm taking care of maybe 600 people, right? But we have about a 30% turnover rate. So it means we're, and most of those, not everybody, some are sort of lost. They move, they die, they, unfortunately, or just lost to follow up. But many of them graduate on. And so we bring them on, develop relationship, focus on getting people housed, physically better, emotionally in a better place, connected to the care that they need. And then when they're at that stage and they've been there and they feel good, we say, hey, congratulations, you know, you're doing really well. We're going to graduate you on to one of our other teams. And that can be a little bit of a bittersweet moment, mm-hmm. being like, people you've really developed a close bond
right,
with.
Right, and heard their stories.
Yeah,
and
yeah. But to be able to hand them off to people that I know and I trust, mm-hmm. and I can share that trust with them, I think is really nice. And, time and again, those stories of, I think I'm in a particularly privileged position because many people who I think work with this population, especially in sort of acute care settings, right, urgent care, emergency room settings, even in the hospital, they only see people at a time of crisis, mm-hmm. right? And so they see Mr. Jones coming back in every week in, you know, in detox or needing a detox, mm-hmm. and then getting belligerent and then storming out and whatnot. And that wears on a person, right? Like you see this again and again. You think it's impossible. You think it can never get better.
And that's everything about the person.
Exactly. Right? Exactly. And that, I don't know how people in those settings like maintain a sense of balance, right? Because if they only see people at a time of crisis and they never get to see change or see resolution, right, then, you know, it wears. Because when Mr. Jones stops showing up, you're not thinking about him. Mm-hmm. Or maybe you do, and then you're just like, oh, I wonder whatever happened to Mr. J. And I'm sure he died or moved on, right? I'm lucky because I see people in crisis for sure every day, right? But I also get to see it when they come back, when they, doc, I got the best, I got a job. Mm-hmm. I'm working again. I moved into my house. I love it. First, I decorated it. Mm-hmm. First time I've ever had a place to decorate. I decided to quit drinking and I'm doing it, right? Like, that resilience, that fortitude, that strength, and I get to see them, you know, reconnecting the family. And that's probably the most joyful thing I get to see when people have found a way to, reconnect with their lives, right? They've moved from survival to living.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that I'm speaking in really general terms.
That's okay.
But the moment of when they can say, you know, I was able to talk to my son the other day and we just had a really nice conversation and you can see them lighting up, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's really powerful. And those are the moments that I think that I get the privilege of getting to see. I hope that other people in sort of other settings can try to keep in the back of mind that it's possible, right? Because I've seen multiple times where somebody who has been, you know, like you'd think they are locked in until death to their addiction,
mm-hmm.
for example. And something changes. And maybe that's the relationship with our team. Like maybe it's coming in and seeing my nurse every week, a couple times a week, and they start to feel better and they feel like there's a possibility of hope. And
somebody cares about them.
Somebody cares, right? That matters. the point about caring, right? Like, a really powerful moment for me was there was a patient who'd had a cervical fracture, like a bad one, and had gotten up and left in the ER, right? And been trying to, had no way to reach him. We had no phone number that worked, no address to send anything to, and just like, well, hope he shows up. And he eventually shows up 6 months later, thankfully not dead or paralyzed, obviously. Walks in, sits down, sitting with my nurse. I don't actually know he's here yet, but I go into the room just to grab some supplies. I'm like, sort of like, hey, how's it going? And sort of not connecting who this is briefly. And I'm rummaging around, and I hear my nurse turn to him and say, I'll make up a name here. Hey, Johnny, it's so glad you made it in. Really glad you're here. And then I hear crying, and I turn around, and the veteran's crying, and we're like, what's going on? Are you okay? And he says, it's been, I can't remember the last time somebody wanted me somewhere. And that was devastating to hear that, right? Like that lack of, that somebody had felt unwelcome for so long.
Right, because, yeah, because otherwise, kind of like, what, why are you back? Which, yeah, so the whole revolving door thing that can contribute to it.
The, another sort of moment that sort of, and it made me shift my practice a little bit because, you know, I just sort of assumed that, you know, I'm a generally kind of welcoming guy and like, you know, I don't kick dogs or anything. I'm a nice guy.
You're a nice guy, yeah.
And so I thought that was enough. Like, but I think there's something important about intentionality. And so when a veteran comes in, I try to remind myself to remember to say, hey, welcome. I'm glad you're here. Welcome to our clinic.
Right.
And mean it. And I do. And there's something else that actually reminded me to the other story that has really stuck with me to help me sort of solidify that lesson was we were, this was just a couple months in to the whole thing. We were down at the Union Gospel Mission, and I see a veteran, and I go to him, and I start giving him my spiel. I'm like, oh, you know, we're from the VA. We're the best. Like, hey, we really want to take care of you. We're going to do all these great things. I'm a, you know, primary care doctor, and I can get you the health care you need and the mental health care or whatever else. And he's like, he looks at me and says, Doc, thank you. That's really kind. It sounds great, but no thank you. I'm good where I'm at. And I'm like, oh, well, that's fantastic. I'm glad. So it sounds like you're already connected somewhere. He's like, oh, yeah, the Pioneer Square Clinic where Nancy Sugg works, right? And I'm like, and he says, yeah, and I'm never leaving that clinic. I'm like, wow, I've trained there a little bit. You know, I've spent some time there, and it's an amazing place, like with, you know, the best staff that you could hope for. But I'm a little surprised at the reaction, right, the strength of the reaction. Very few people are like,
I'm good. I'm staying here.
Like, and so I'm like, you know, it's a great place, but what made it so powerful? You know, that was a pretty strong reaction. What do you like so much about Pioneer Square Clinic? He told me that, you know, the first time he'd gone there, just walked in for an urgent care visit, and they took care of his needs, and he left. It was fine. It was good experience. But nothing like, you know, crazy out of the ordinary. Goes back like 6 months later, second time he's ever been there. Walks in the door, and the first thing somebody says to him is, well, a security guard turns to him and says, hey, good to see you again. And that blew his mind, right? That somebody remembered him and cared about him enough to say,
and a security guard.
And the security guard, right?
Yeah.
And that stuff matters. That stuff matters a lot.
It does.
Like, and, you know, that's, you know, there have been multiple studies looking at how often people have had some sort of discrimination, you know, on the basis of, you know, homelessness. And shockingly high, right? You know, equivalent to sort of racial discrimination or higher than that, you know? So you come in, you haven't been able to shower for a couple of days, or you've got your luggage and people don't want to shake your hand, or they don't look you in the eye.
Or they put a hazmat suit on before they'll touch you.
Exactly. And just craziness, right? And people feel disrespected. Of course they feel disrespected because, you know. And it's an issue of respect and dignity, right? Like even when we don't mean to, we can inadvertently do that kind of thing. Sure, one more story along those lines, sort of that way that that interaction can go badly. I was down at the Downtown Emergency Service Center, and, and Mary Pilgrim, who I think you've interviewed.
Yes, definitely.
She's the best. Like, you know, I think she single-handedly prevents more Medic One call or than anybody else in this city by taking care of people. But anyway, I go in. And she's like, hey, this isn't a vet, but could you just come over and take a look at something? I'm like, sure, no problem. Go into the sick room, and there's a man laying there. And he looks terrible. I mean, like, gaunt. And, I mean, pretty emaciated looking. His arms kind of looking at a funny angle and covered in, you know, some scabs and things and doesn't look well. And I'm like, my God, he looks terrible. And she's like, no, just come over here. And we, he turns out he's had some sort of head and neck cancer. He ended up having a laryngectomy. He can't really speak well just at all. Just can kind of really got to make an effort to sort of understand him, right? And she says, and he's got this broken arm here that didn't set right and sort of was broken like, you know, 6 months, a year ago and it's pretty painful. It's bothersome. But again, that's not the problem. It's not the cancer. It's not the broken bones that haven't been taken care of. She's like, look at this. It's like, Mr. So-and-so, can you please sit up? It's Dr. Reddy. I just want him to take a look at something. Lifts up his shirt and there on the back of his spine, like right over that thoracic section, is like a grapefruit-sized abscess. No idea how deep it goes, right? I mean, it is red. It is hot. That thing has got to drain, and it's got to be taken care of by a surgeon, clearly. I mean, there is no other option here. And I turn to Mary. I'm like, why isn't he at the hospital right now? You know, obviously, she's like, of course I sent him to the hospital. I sent him up to Harborview. Now, Harborview is a place I trained. I'm proud to have trained there. It is a remarkable place and takes care of the city in an amazing way and empathetic, wonderful people there. But stuff happens, right? Just like in any emergency room. This man with cancer, barely able to speak for himself.
Broken arm.
Broken arm. Had gone up there for this abscess, right? And gets evaluated, and we end up looking at the note, and it's basically like, it's got chronic pain, here for pain meds. Told him this needs to be taken care of as an outpatient, discharged. The exam is basically like, lungs clear, heart regular, you know, broken arm, but nothing to do about that now. It's fine. Nothing about the abscess. Didn't see it. Didn't look at it. Didn't notice it.
Just thought that he was drug seeking.
Yeah. And man, this man, I will never forget the look in his eye. Like he was tearing up, like tears of rage. Like he was so angry. He was humiliated, and he was adamant that he would not go back there. And Mary, thankfully, sorry, I shared my thoughts with him. I told him I was worried. Mary eventually got him to go back to the hospital, but he was like, definitely not there. I'll go anywhere else. So they sent him to Swedish and got taken care of. But stuff happens every day in every emergency room and every clinic, probably including in mine. I've probably missed things because I've been overly dismissive, haven't been open in the way that I need to be. But that was a particularly stark reminder of how you need to be intentional and how you need to take a moment to stop and really pay close attention.
And check your own kind of like biases and judgments.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. The, So I think But yeah, anyway.
And biggest frustrations? I mean, that's probably one of them, right?
Sure.
When any of us kind of like miss something or get judgment. But what other kinds of
frustrations?
Frustrations, yeah.
You know, I think the frustrations that you see, so the joys, right, are when you see people after who, however they've been struggling, get the hand up that they need to move forward, right, and find meaning in life, and that may be work, that might be family, that might just be a safe place to be where they can collect themselves for a minute.
And decorate for the first
right?
time, yeah.
Absolutely, absolutely. Sometimes it's even, you know, sort of a sadness to it, but a joy in that somebody gets into housing and then subsequently dies, but in a place that's warm and comfortable and they felt safe for a minute, that at least it wasn't on the streets. That has its own sort of sad joy to it as well. The frustrations, you know, every day, right? It's the frustration, you know, I think there's this, the frustrations at structural issues, you know, bureaucratic issues, socioeconomic issues, the housing crisis, all that. And I could talk forever about those things. But then there's also the frustrations when you think you know best, right? Mm-hmm. And you're like, why won't you just please do this thing that I think will benefit you? Like, why are you making this bad decision again? You know, why are you going back to the same person who's been abusive to you? Like, why are you refusing this housing, you know, for what seem like nonsensical reasons, right? Why can't you? Why don't you? You know. And it took me a long while to come to grips with that, right? That primary care is about the long game. That care about anybody is about the long game. That the most powerful thing you do is you develop a relationship. You show that you care and that you're ready to be there for them when they're ready. You give your advice. They may choose to ignore it, and that's fine. We'll still be here if you change your mind even if you don't, and that's fine too. And ultimately, that has been far more successful a strategy than me banging my head against a wall.
Mm-hmm.
One of the best pieces of advice I got about sort of medicine generally was back in medical school. It was a surgeon. And who I think, you know, I've always thought of as sort of like people who fix things, right?
The kind of the abscess on the guy's back,
right,
yeah.
Right. You know, they see a problem, go in, they take care of that problem, like cut and dry, right? And surgeon says, you know, we make a mistake when we think we fix people, any of us in medicine. And we never fix people. All we do is we set the stage and people heal where they don't. And if you set that stage well, maybe they've got a better chance of healing. And I think that was particularly powerful coming from somebody who carries a knife, you know, that you try to make it easier for people to heal. And then be okay with it if that's not what's going to happen right now. Like there was a young veteran who had developed an opiate use disorder after losing a lot of comrades in Afghanistan, and had developed bad clots everywhere, was really struggling. Homeless, and didn't really, you know, just for a brief period of time seemed to get sober and then relapsed and was really struggling, was not coming in. And, you know, months after I'd last seen him, I was like thinking about him and wrote him a letter and was like, I hope this letter finds you and that it finds you well. And I just want to let you know that you're always welcome here. We're worried about you. Just let us know if you're okay. It was a weird way to write for a physician, I think, and for me. Like, it was not sort of the...
Like, you need to come in for a TB test or ordering something.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it might be the way I talk, but it's not the way I write usually. Just like, hey, I'm worried about you. Please let us know if you're okay. 3 months later, he comes in with that letter. He'd eventually gotten it. In the end, you know, he's... I can't say that the final outcome was what I would, you know, I've lost track again, honestly. Mm-hmm. And I hope he returns one day. But we at least gave us another shot. And so that was helpful for me to remember that.
Mm-hmm.
That when as long as you're there when people are ready, mm-hmm. it makes a difference.
Well, it could completely make a difference. He could be some other city, and because of that, he kind of goes back in and gets mm-hmm. care somewhere else.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's been certainly a learning process, right? So this is my fourth or fifth year. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, when I came in, I had this clinic, a primary care clinic, actually at Harborview, and their HIV clinic when I was in my training. But when I finished, I didn't really know how to – like when I finished my residency, like I could pretty easily keep somebody alive through a night, right? I could
mm-hmm.
put in a catheter, like put them on the pressors, like give them the antibiotics, do what you need to and help somebody survive a night in the ICU, like at least reasonably well. Somebody comes in with like saying, oh, my shoulder hurts when I do this. My first response is like, well, don't do that. You know, like, you know, like I didn't know how to be a primary care doctor very well. I mean, okay, but like not where I needed to be. And then so it's been a real learning curve for me, like trying to get better every day. And I'm better than I was, but I'm not where I want to be,
mm-hmm.
I think. It sort of brings me to another bit of advice that sort of stuck with me since medical school, which was this is from a psychiatrist. And he like has a little tiny group of us third year medical students who basically don't know anything. And he turns to us and he says, listen, just remember, whenever you're going in to see a patient, you might be the best doctor that patient ever sees, which scared the crap out of us,
mm-hmm.
right? We're third year medical students. And he was like saying like, well, you might be the one to have the time to listen and pick up the thing that they, you know, whatever it may be. But it's really scary. And, you know, I'm not even the best doctor on my hallway. And so it takes a certain amount of hubris to right before walking into a clinic room, be like, maybe for this patient, I'll be the best doctor that they'll ever encounter. And so I really need to bring my A game and to strive for excellence.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been helpful in getting better, I guess.
Right. Well, it sounds like you kind of balance that with the surgeon's advice about setting the stage.
I think
there's
exactly
that humility
right.
too.
Yes.
That's exactly right. Yes, you know, have your best game there,
right.
but it takes other things.
Right.
Yeah.
I think those are the two – I think you're absolutely right. Those are the two poles between that sort of my practice of medicine mm-hmm. sort of falls in. Yeah.
Nice. So what are your hopes for the future of kind of like the basic safety net healthcare in King County and also our country?
Yeah. I mean, this interview is taking place, you know,
during
11 days after the inauguration of President Trump. And it's been a chaotic couple mm-hmm. of weeks, obviously. Huge political ramifications, obviously. And it's been disconcerting. It's been scary. And not just for me, but for my patients
mm-hmm.
who will... sometimes bring this up on their own, fears about what it'll mean for the VA. And even already, I'll talk about the concrete ways that things have changed, that I'd been hopeful about getting a grant to expand our team,
mm-hmm.
to get a new social worker, get another provider, at least part-time, get another nurse, at least part-time. Which I think would have expanded our ability to provide care. That's all in the air. Who knows if that's going to happen mm-hmm. or not. The hiring freeze has pushed back our ability to get a nursing assistant. Hopefully that process will restart, but, you know, hard to be sure of that. Mm-hmm. That's just within the VA, which at the end of the day is I think, going to be more protected than many of the other social safety net programs in our country. Like, as the Affordable Care Act comes under the chopping block without sort of a clear explanation for how we're going to ensure access to care for people, it's scary. I think I think brighter minds than mine have probably commented on these issues, and but my hope is that as a nation, and sort of at least as a state, that we will choose to continue to fund these safety net programs, right? Because I think the thing to remember about these programs, right? These aren't handouts. I mean, these are, like, the VA is not a handout. ACA is not a handout. The safety net programs generally are not handouts. This is the price we pay to ensure that our community is healthy, that our neighbors and ourselves, that when we fall in hard times, we can bounce back.
Everybody,
our kids, right? That of the veterans I care for the, you know, the vast majority of them, they're not looking to continue to live on the government dime for the rest of their lives. Most of them want to reconnect with life, and but once you are in a hole, it is hard to dig your way out of it, you know, mm-hmm. without someone needs to throw in a rope once in a while. And the thing that has been remarkable to me, people have these sometimes have preconceptions about what a homeless person looks like, what a homeless veteran looks like, right? That it's a drug-addicted, mentally ill Vietnam-era veteran standing on a street corner with a sign. Maybe. But that person can get their life back together, and I've seen that. But the other thing that's been remarkable to me is how close to the edge we all are, that the people I've cared for have been, all of them, certainly have been soldiers, sailors, veterans of all kinds, right, and have served their country. And have fallen in hard times at some point in their life, right? By the time that I've seen them.
Mm-hmm.
But they have been real estate agents, small business owners, cooks, priests, actually, nurses, social workers. And what leads to homelessness is typically a crisis of some kind. And none of us are immune to a crisis. The loss of a family member, the loss of family through divorce or something like that, a health issue. And these are the things that I wish people could see, that we are so much closer to the edge than we think. But that if we live in a society where if somebody falls over, there's somebody willing to help them stand back up, to mix metaphors a little bit, we are going to live in a better place. That this is an investment in our people, and that's important. I think the VA is an example of some of that success, like that we see veterans moving forward with their lives
mm-hmm.
Because they have access. You know, the VA has been plagued by problems, certainly, but at the end of the day, it is providing really good quality, high quality care for many, many, for most veterans, and helping them and thinking about it in a comprehensive way. That healthcare is not about what pills you get. Healthcare is about being sure you are emotionally and mentally healthy as well, that you have access. Like, somebody walks into my clinic on a Monday, right? Like, let's say this come yesterday, somebody walks in, homeless veteran walks in, and they can be seen for their primary care with me, or they can see a mental health provider that same day. They can have a housing intake and find out what housing options they might have access to. They can talk to a lawyer, like if they, not a VA lawyer, but a pro bono person mm-hmm. who comes by, if that's something that's going to be a barrier for them. They can get the medications that they might need. They can get connected to addiction treatment the following day. Like, that comprehensive wraparound kind of support is what people need to get back to their life. And you asked about the joys that I see, and the joy is seeing people moving from surviving to living. Mm-hmm. And I see that a lot. And when people have the tools that they need.
The VA has been a huge bright spot in terms of not ending homelessness, but making a huge dent.
Yeah. I mean, going back to when we first started talking, right, like this desire to end homelessness, right?
Mm-hmm.
They knew at the time that it was moonshot, right? And but they went for it. And in, these now 6 years that have passed or whatever it is, 7 years now, veteran homelessness has dropped by more than 50% across mm-hmm. the nation. We're not there yet in Seattle or in Puget Sound because of the housing crisis, mm-hmm. frankly, not the homelessness crisis, the housing crisis. But it would be a lot worse if we weren't doing, if our housing people weren't doing what they were doing, if we didn't have the resources to help people get back on their feet. So nice. It's my little soapbox.
So is there anything that I haven't asked you at all that you would want to kind of end with?
Actually, I do want to talk briefly about sort of the politics and advocacy for a moment. So the other hat I wear, aside from being, proud federal employee mm-hmm. at the VA, is as a board member for the Seattle King County Coalition on Homelessness,
mm-hmm.
Which is an advocacy group here in town that tries to focus on ensuring the safety of people who are homeless now and ending homelessness generally. These last few years especially have been particularly trying in terms of our community, in terms of homelessness in our community. Numbers are skyrocketing, et cetera. And the debate around it has become more rancorous than it should. That in some ways it feels as though we want an easy solution to the homelessness crisis. We all do. Of course we do. But then we end up separating out homelessness response from the housing crisis and, mm-hmm. and treating them like they're two distinct problems when they're intricately interrelated. That it's and the rhetoric becomes, well, homeless services are not sufficiently coordinated, and the issue is efficiency.
And we need to count them.
Right.
More. Yeah.
Right. It becomes about that without. It becomes about data and analytics, but not using the best data or analytics. I'll get back to that. But the issue around that the reason that we are struggling with homelessness is that our homelessness response services are insufficient. Well, no, that's certainly they can be more coordinated, and they will be. And they've been working on this already,
mm-hmm.
Like how to improve coordination across the myriad service organizations in the community. Improving efficiency, absolutely. Who doesn't want to improve efficiency in any program, including housing and homelessness services? But fundamentally, this is like musical chairs, right? You can change the song however many times you want, but at the end of the day, there's not enough chairs. And that is a big structural socioeconomic issue that partially related to development policies and land use policies and all of that sort of thing that have been decades in the coming, as well as, frankly, the really wonderful economic boom that we have. We have tremendous amount of employers, great job growth, that kind of thing, and you know, rising inequality. And so you have people being priced out of their homes, and well, that's, you can work on the outflow, like trying to improve getting people out of homelessness, but focusing on the inflow is really important too. Mm-hmm. And they're not either or. It's not like building a shelter means that you can't build affordable housing. That I think our responsibility is to work on, as a community, creating sufficient affordable housing that we can maintain maintain our community well and sort of decrease the amount of homelessness that develops. But at the same time, and this is not either or, this, they have to go hand in hand, that you focus on safety, right? That when somebody is outside, what can we do to help them be safer until a solution comes along, right? And people talk about, well, you know, shelters are Band-Aids, mm-hmm. right? Well, if somebody comes in bleeding, you know, you put a bandage on mm-hmm. first, and then you figure it out. They have to go hand in hand. And, you know, I think, for example, I think our mayor has done more around the issue of homelessness than virtually any mayor prior, sort of recognizing the severity of the problem, making efforts towards increasing shelter space somewhat. But at the same time, counterproductive things happen, things like sweeps that disrupt people's lives, you know, people who are already on the edge, and all of a sudden you don't have your documents, your medications, mm-hmm. and have nowhere to go, and you just get moved around. It's not helpful. Anyway, I'm rambling a little bit, but I think it is imperative that we work on both affordable housing as well as a sufficient safety net for people who are homeless. There's this a question that I get often from people, you know, friends and stuff, or, you know, how often aren't people coming to Seattle for all our services,
yeah.
right?
They're not ours. Yeah.
Right. And, you know, I think that's something that first-line responders, you know, like medics, nursing, like providers all see too, right? They meet somebody who came up here from Florida or wherever, and they're like, oh, if only those people just stayed home, this would be fine. But anecdotes aren't data. And the best data on this suggests that that is not the case,
mm-hmm.
that the people who are homeless in our community are from our community, or they moved here for opportunity.
Exactly. Just like
everybody else.
Everybody else. Like
if you just, you know, meet Seattleites generally and ask them where they're from, you know.
Not too many that are from really from here. Yeah.
In fact, the VA has good data on this, you know, just published last year where they tracked – they looked at where veterans who were struggling with homelessness had utilized care,
mm-hmm.
and it was inevitably in people moved after they became homeless. Maybe 20-30% of them moved after mm-hmm. becoming homeless, which you'd expect. You move for opportunity. You move for a wide variety of reasons. But the net flow was even. There was basically no community. Los Angeles, San Francisco, Seattle, none of those places, right, that we sort of think of as
the magnets.
Magnets,
or, yeah.
right, where there were more veterans coming in than going out. It was, including Seattle, basically the same.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it seems like a lot of people are coming from elsewhere, but that's because we forget about the people who already left because they were not surviving here and they went looking for opportunity. I got a guy who moved here for a job, had a job in hand, he thought, and, you know, a couple months worth of money to support himself and that kind of thing. Gets here, job is not present at all,
mm.
right? Quickly uses up his money trying to stay at motels looking for work, but it doesn't happen for him, and then stays with an acquaintance or friend who thinks he's going to be able to stay there long enough to find employment that'll be But then the friend kicks him out because his girlfriend wants to move in and like has a day's notice and is all of a sudden on the streets. And mm-hmm. this is a man who'd been in special forces and had gone on some pretty hairy missions previously. And he said this was the first night that he was like actually a little scared.
That's pretty interesting, isn't it?
Assaulted that like two nights later, you know, sleeping under a bush, trying to figure, because he's never been homeless before, has no idea what to do. And he, you know, is trying to survive, stays where he is, and two guys come up and try to take his things. He fights back, but he doesn't want to be fighting. Right? It's a dangerous situation. And people move for opportunity. People aren't, I think it takes a certain amount of, I don't know what it is exactly when somebody says, I think the reason that there are so many people dying on our streets is that we are too generous. I don't see any evidence of that. I went to memorial service for the people who died this last year, and sadly, I recognized more names than I wanted to on that list. And it's down at the Compass Center, and for every name that was spoken, candle was lit.
It was back in December.
Yeah. Those two tables were just ablaze with tiny little candles.
And a fairly large proportion that, you know, in terms of the whole opiate epidemic too.
Yeah. People dying of opiates, dying of assault.
Yeah, it also sounds like, I mean, just the balance that you're talking about, but what I was also just hearing with that is a balance between your kind of like direct service, working as a physician, as you've been trained and educated to do, but then also working on advocacy and politics. Is that?
Yeah, I think so, and I think I do my very best to separate the two. That I don't speak for the VA when I do my advocacy work. You know, my direct service work informs my advocacy, but. Like if I share a story, details are changed. Like there's nothing that should be traced back to anybody, for example, and I try to speak in very general terms. But I think the direct service sort of powers the advocacy. Mm-hmm. It says, this is why this matters. It reminds me every day.
You have the credibility to speak on that.
I wish it was my patients who could do the speaking, but you know, I never ask them about that. I don't offer sort of advocacy as sort of. I know there are other providers who would feel like that might be therapeutic, but that's sort of been the clear line I've tried to draw for myself. That I am really, when I'm doing my service for my employer, and well for the veterans, my job is to be there for them, and then I go home, switch hats, and try to do the advocacy.
Right.
And anyway. Yeah.
Right.
There's a lot of good people, a lot of really good intentioned people in this city, in this community, trying to do the right thing. And my hope is that this crisis will pass and that we will have a real shot at ending homelessness. When I took my job, actually, that was the first time I learned of the VA's commitment to end homelessness. And I laughed because I thought it was ridiculous. Having seen what is possible, I believe it's possible.
Right.
Having seen what the VA's done.
Yeah, and some of the researchers are also pointing out that it's because it's a coordinated system. I mean, as you said, the VA, even healthcare is not perfect.
Yeah.
But just in terms of having a unified wraparound services available to people, that all helps to actually end homelessness. Yeah.
Anyway.
So thank you so much for the work that you do and also for taking time away from the VA today to come speak with me. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.